Hi, folks. How are you? Still a little bit croaky, not quite as bad as I was, thankfully. Thank you so much for all your lovely well wishes and various tips on remedies. I have a fully stocked medicinal herbal cupboard now, so very much appreciated. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of my beloved podcast Soundtrack, and where I talk to people about film and music. And what I always say is that we're not an exclusive club. This is very much open to everyone and anyone and all level of film fans. We never want to feel like we're niche. There are some weeks where we might go deep in on conversations with smaller, more unknown people, but I hope there's something in there for everyone. And well, this particular episode is no exception, because, well, you'll find out in a second. But we've got some great, great guests coming up over the next couple of weeks. Lin-Manuel Miranda is going to be joining us. Reggie Yates talking about his debut feature film Pirates. Chloe Zhao, who we got to talk to about Eternals. Pablo Laran, who's made this incredible film called Spencer. Paolo Sorrentino as well, The Hand of God, is his new film, but I also talked to him about The Great Beauty. So loads of great guests on the way. But our latest guest, as we continue to supply you with two episodes a week, I hope you're enjoying that. Well, this gentleman has undoubtedly had more mentions on this podcast than anyone else by, I would say, quite some distance. And now, so great, we finally have him in person. And I will say now that I hope that this is the first of a whole series of chats that we can do with the one and only Hans Zimmer. Now, he's scored in excess of 150 films and been instrumental in developing the careers of, well, numerous composers, including Lorne Balfe, Harry Gregson-Williams, who've both appeared on this podcast. And he's worked with just about everyone who's anyone in the film business, and joins us today to discuss his two latest blockbusters, Dune and No Time to Die. And they are both very different films and very different asks of him as well. Now, we'll aim to get him back, as I said, hopefully for a proper retrospective very soon. But in the meantime, let's enjoy what he has to offer us in cinemas now. Starting with a cue from Dune called Night of Arrakis. Hans Zimmer, where do we start, sir? Where do we start?
Well, since of my childhood, you know, I don't know.
The idea that for over 40 minutes we can even scrape the surface of your incredible work would be an impossible feat. But I would love to talk to you about two particular things, if that's okay. One of those being Dune and the other of those being Bond. So can we start with Dune first, if you don't mind?
Yeah, absolutely. It only took Denis and me 40 years to go and make this movie.
Well, it's worth waiting for.
Denis is younger than me. God, everybody's younger than me these days. But we both read the book when we were teenagers. And, you know, usually when you tackle a subject that you read as a teenager, you look at it as an adult. You look at it through different eyes. You don't look at it through the child's eye anymore. And you look at it with wisdom and all that stuff straight. This was different. This was like it took us right back to where we were when we were 13, 14. And we were reckless and we would experiment and we would go and not be afraid to make sounds that might be unpleasant. And I don't know, you know, it's like go for it. Go and give people an experience. Go and try to paraphrase the experience it gave us then. and take you for, you know, like they always say that movies, oh, they take you, you know, we're taking you for a ride, you know, and it's going to be an adventure, it's going to be an experience and all that. But I really do think there is an experience in this movie that is different. And I think Denis is such an extraordinary artist. One thing you need to know is I never saw the David Lynch movie. And I know there's some television bits and pieces floating around as well. So I never saw these because when I was reading the book, I was sort of making my own movie in my head, you know, yeah. The way you do.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that. When I heard the David Lynch movie was like, whatever, 90 minutes or whatever, I knew he couldn't tell that story in that time. And so I didn't want them to blunt the vision I had. And when Denis came to me, and it was just the way, just the tone of his voice, it's just this, you know, just gently going, did I ever, he didn't presume, you know, he didn't presume that I would do it. He didn't presume that I would know it. He very carefully, and I could tell he was being careful because the answer was very important to him. He very carefully said, have I ever heard of a book called Dune? And I think my answer scared him a little bit because I went to one my full freak out. Oh, you have no idea, you know, as a teenager, favorite this and then the other. But I could see that for him it was as important that it was somebody who it had resonated with as a teenager and who could still think like a teenager. Even though, I mean, look, I just turned 64 and somebody asked me, when am I going to slow down? And as they were saying it, I was like, literally like this rush of this thought came, you know, and I just spat out at them. What do you mean slow down? I'm just getting going here.
Yes.
So both those projects were projects which were all about friendship. They were all about, like, very interesting working with Denis. Second time when we work together, but you know, usually that there's a discussion that takes place where you go, well, I have this idea and let me explain it to you, and da da da, and then questions are being asked, and you try to explain music, which is inexplicable in the first place. You can either you play it and it either resonates or you just throw it in the bin. But with Denis, it would be like starting a sentence and then he would finish it. Or he would start a sentence and I would finish it. And sometimes he could finish, very importantly as well, our editor, Joe Walker, who I'd worked with the first time in 1988 when we were whippersnappers at the BBC.
No.
When we were children. We were children at the BBC. So, and Joe went to music school and I didn't. So there's always that thing whereby I have unbelievable faith in Joe, where I feel I can be more reckless than normal because Joe went to music school and he's going to tell me when I fuck it up. All right. And so the team is vital. The team in this and the whole sound design team as well, Theo Green and Mark Mangini, because at the end of the day, what I like is I come from bands. You know, I come from being in a band, and I just invite everybody into the and the COVID thing was weird because for a while we couldn't be a band.
Yeah.
And I had to rethink things. And I mean it did create an interesting thing whereby I was suddenly working with musicians from all over the world. Like, I mean, I'd have a team, I'd have bagpipes going on in Scotland. I'd have some string players doing some weird stuff, which in Vienna, I had Lisa Gerard doing things in Australia. I had my friend Laura Kotler, who's the main voice you hear in Dune.
Yeah,
she was recording in her clothes cupboard, and I have a beautiful photo of her sitting in the bottom of her cupboard with her skirts hanging on her head and her coats, etc. Because that, you know, and at the same time making this sound that travels across, you know, miles and miles of desert, you know, this endless,
wow.
You know, this endless horizons. so, you know, and people, you know, people in London who were in lockdown, and then that sort of, and then sort of we figured out a way of, you know, where that just became stupid and it just became counterproductive. And my studio's big enough that everybody could come in and be sort of, look, put it that way, everybody's still alive.
Do you know what, it's funny, because I was lucky enough to speak to Denis maybe about 3 weeks ago. And I asked him, because you can hear how much this book means to him when he talks about it. And I asked him whether the film is what he imagined the world would be when he read it as a teenager. And he got really emotional because he said, absolutely, I made this film for my teenage self. And there are moments within the film that are exactly what I saw in my head when I read that book and when I knew that this book meant something to me.
Ditto. And I think that's why we got on so well, and why it was such an interesting experience, whereby, you know, I could leave being 64 years old behind and just be 13, 14 again. You know, and there is wisdom in being 13, 14. It's just a different type of wisdom. It's finding out that the world is impossible to navigate, and you still at the same time figure out some crazy ways of navigating it. Mm-hmm. And then you come across a book, and there's that mantra about fear is the mind killer, you know, et cetera, in it. Just when you're taking your first hesitant steps out into the world, and it's all terrifying, and it's all a desert. It's all a desert. It's all foreign. It's all, you might, everything is science fiction when you're a teenager and you take your first steps out into the world. Everything is foreign and everything is hostile. And at the same time, everything that you grasp or touch or listen to or hear or converse with is wisdom that you've never had before. So it was a pleasure to go back to that place.
Do you think it felt like, I don't know, because from hearing and reading a few things that you said about the experience of this, is it was a very, not a different experience, but the idea that, like you say, when you were talking to Denis and Joe, there was no barriers really in terms of anything goes really, and you could play and you could discover and you could create. And that creation includes creating new sounds.
We didn't just create new sounds. We built new instruments. I mean, I have a friend, Chas Smith. He's a musician. He makes sculptures out of metal, and he's a welder because he has to be, right? And his whole place in Northern California. I mean, I don't think he will be offended if I say he's one of the last great hippie thinkers in this world. His whole place is one resonating chamber made out of metals. He has some inns with all sorts of dodgy people at Boeing and Lockheed that give him scraps of metal that, you know, that they're going to go and bin. And he explains to me what they're called, and I can't even pronounce them. And I promise you wouldn't know, but it's like, so there are those instruments which are bowed or stretched or tortured or blown or whatever you want to do with it. And then my friend Urs Heckmann in Berlin makes these wonderful synthesizers, and I kept asking for things, you know, like without actually explaining to him why I needed this or why, you know, why we were coming up with this. And he just sort of build it and, you know, give us these things that could make impossible sounds and morph, you know, like morph a cello into the sound of some Tibetan war horn or the bagpipes, you know.
Yes, I cheered when I heard the bagpipes.
who would have thought that in the middle of the pandemic, I can find 30 great players in Edinburgh and drag them into a church and make a righteous noise, you know? And I said, and I was, listen, that is a shot in the movie. And I said to Denis, why the bagpipes? And he said, well, look, heralding trumpets is the wrong thing, but an ancient instrument like that seems to, you know, and we were constantly trying to do this, that we were trying to cross time and space in a peculiar sort of way, where the female voice was the most important instrument to us all.
So important.
Because to us, the true strength of the movie is the female, the females and the women in the movie. So even when they're not on the screen, there will be a little bit of Laura Kottner or Lisa Gerrard or somewhere in the score.
Did you create your own language as well as what they sang? Is that right?
I'm cheating a bit. Denis didn't cheat. Denis didn't cheat. He had a professor come in who really knows how to do this and invent languages that are based in logic and fact. The language I used is really Lisa Gerrard. I kept making her do things. I just kept saying, okay, do something else, do something else. This went on for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then one day she sent me something and it was like a poem. And it was really quite long, but it all made sense. But you couldn't understand a word. Well, you know, but everything made sense. It was a chant, really.
Yeah.
And I could tell she had sort of found some space in her where this language existed and where this language could come out. And so that, and of course, her being a singer, it's an important thing that language isn't just language, but if you want to use it in music, that it sings well.
You start with the I imagine the conversations were constantly ongoing, but when you were sitting down with June to work to start actually creating, what was the starting point?
Maybe actually I shouldn't be telling you this because it's not in the movie. In the book there are all these songs that different characters sing, so I can't remember where I was. I must have been in London or something. You know, I would get phone calls from Denis or from Joe Walker going, oh, we're going to shoot the song tomorrow. Can you quickly whip up something? So So the inn was a sort of a funny one where I would be writing these songs that to Frank Herbert's lyrics, and none of them were dutifully filmed and dutifully recorded, and they're not in the movie because, you know, some things have to go.
Yeah.
And they weren't driving the story forward. But it was a good exercise to find like a sonic thing. And then really the place I started was I wrote a piece called Paul's Dream.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Sort of became the foundation for everything else, and that became, like I said to Laura Kotler, the singer, I said, can you do like a, I wanted to be like the cry of a woman, but I wanted to be fierce, I wanted to be like a war chant, I wanted to be like, you know, and she's such a sweetheart, she's so gentle. And this track came back, which was like, the first note tears your eyeballs out, the second note rips your head off, and the third note just basically kills you. And it's you know, full of commitment. It's not a session singer. It's not a normal performance. It's just some, I don't know, some archetypal scream that goes across the universe. like anything else, you know, I can't take credit for anything. I can take credit for maybe being an architect in some of these things, but getting other people to perform. I mean, the bagpipes, the, you know, a lot of the stuff is my friend Guthrie Govan and Tina Guerra, the cellist, but they don't sound like a cellist and he doesn't sound like a guitarist. It's those sort of things where you go and say, well, we're going to try something completely different.
You're like the chef and they're all your ingredients.
Absolutely. Well, my ingredients are people I trust. My ingredients are people I love. My ingredients are people that have enormous skills and enormous talent. And my ingredients are people that are reckless and are prepared to go and take things further and beyond where you're supposed to go. They're prepared to go a little experimental.
I love the premonition cue as well. That's one of my favorite cues. I think it's a beautiful, the build on it is just, oh, it's so great.
Thank you. You know, I wanted to immerse you in a way. I wanted to give you an experience that, you know, because this is only part one. But
I shouted at the screen, though. When the film finished, I shouted at the screen. I was like, no, because I didn't want it to end. I was,
Denis is writing. I've written another hour and a half of music that's ready to go, you know. And I'm sort of been writing it so that he doesn't have to be alone, you know, with his typewriter or with his word processor or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would keep him company by sending him pieces of music, you know.
I love that. It's great. But you've written two scores pretty much anyway for this anyway, because you've also written a whole suite to accompany the book as well. Yeah.
Well, that it just felt like the right, well, it's based, of course, on the material, on the existing material. So it wasn't like starting from scratch, but it just felt like, wow, look at this. I love the way the art looks in the movie. I love those amazing panels. I love on the walls of the room, etc. And I just thought, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we did something and you got the book and you could stuff, you know, it's like I got it during COVID when you would go to a restaurant, you would aim your iPhone at a thing and the menu would pop up, right?
Yeah.
So I thought, well, if we could do that, then music can pop up. So as you go through this book, you know, you have an oral, you know, you're being carried along very slowly by strange sounds and strange music.
Well, we're going to move on to Bond for a bit as well now, because, I mean, talk about, you know, sort of having a couple of slightly large projects that are coming out. I basically feel like they're reigniting us back into cinema as well, you know, in terms of if there are two things that will attract people back into the cinema, it's Bond and Dune, which is fantastic.
Well, both were made never with the intent that they would be shown on anything other than the cinema.
Absolutely.
Both were designed, crafted. Look, I'm pretty sure that there are elements in Dune, just like there are elements in Bond, that will not actually work, you know, as far as the music's concerned, will not work on anything other than a big set of speakers. I mean, I had that on The Dark Knight. They decided they're going to do the vinyl version of the soundtrack. And they kept sending it back to me saying, there's 20 seconds of silence. I'm going, there isn't 20 seconds of silence. And until like the third or fourth or fifth time that it came back, I realized that the cutting head couldn't cut bass, you know? And so we managed to cut it, but there are people who listen to the vinyl at home on their whatever they have, and they write in and they go, there's 20 seconds of silence. Why is there 20 seconds of silence? Well, because your speakers aren't big enough, you know? So what am I going to do? Am I going to aim for the lowest common denominator, or am I going to go and aim for the highest common denominator? And with the weird parallel between Bond and Dune for me is the sort of the people involved, where Denis has been dreaming about Dune for 40 years. And Daniel has made five movies, but they're not five movies, they're 16 years of his life.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an investment of life, you know? And I was very aware of that I didn't want to let him down. You mean, it's like, and I don't think we did. you know, and the sort of, you know, my friend Steve Massaro, who was vital, you know, he doesn't get enough credit. He was vital in this process, but he's quiet and I'm the noisy one.
And Johnny Marr, let's not forget Johnny Marr.
We're going to come to Johnny Marr. Johnny Marr, that's a simple one. Okay, well, we can do Johnny Marr in one go. look, Barbara Broccoli and I have been friends for years. I never thought I'd do a Bond movie.
Really?
No, I never thought. No, didn't. You know, I thought it'd be dangerous. That, you know, what if I made a mess of it and it would ruin the friendship? And I just, you know, it takes more courage to work with friends than to work with strangers, because you know you don't want the friendship to fall apart because you're incompetent, whatever. But the Johnny, as soon as she said you want to go and do it, I said I gotta go and check with somebody. I phoned Johnny and I said, Johnny, if there's one guitar tune that is legitimately into a movie, what is it? He goes, Bond. I'm going, exactly. Do you want to do it? He goes, yeah, of course. I'm going, you're on. And so phoned Barbara back going, we are on. And then you know, like the Billy song as well, was like a friend of ours had said to me, you're going to get inundated with songs. You know, everybody wants to write a song for Bond. You know, there's going to be a pile of songs. But I know in there it's going to be a little song, quiet, humble. Have a listen to that. And, you know, like everything else is like, you know, vast, massive, da da da. And there was the song that Phineas and Billy had done. And I just loved it. I just thought it was so moody as hell. I thought it was really brilliant. And I thought what was so great was that it wasn't screaming at you. It was inviting you in. It was taking you on a journey and all this stuff. But, you know, literally, it wasn't quite right. And people were going, yeah, but it's not the movie. It's not right. And I'm going, of course it's not right. They haven't seen the movie. Get them on a plane. And I think the way I remember it, because everything was like crazy and in a rush and in a daze of jet lag and everything. I think by the time I said the word plane, they were already sitting in the cutting room watching the movie. And I mean, that was just a delightful adventure. And again, it was like, oh, Billy Eilish, Phineas, and Johnny Marr. That's a good combo. You know, that, nobody's done that before. And yes, of course, that end chord in the song is Johnny. Because I needed a song that wasn't just a song that could work in the beginning. I needed something that would tell story all the way through.
I should have known I'd leave alone. Just goes to show that the blood you bleed is just the blood you own. We were a pair, but I saw you there. Too much to bear. You were my life, but life is far away from fair.
So there are a couple of points in the movie. Billy's actually singing. She's not singing the words. She's just humming. But it's like she's a ghost. She's a beautiful ghost in the movie.
Well, you know, he has his own, he has, that's the great thing, he has his ghost in the movie. He has, you know, exactly, in terms of the female ghost right. in his life, he has M and he also has Eva's character, you know, so that's amazing.
So that was a you know, again, a good way of doing something where it didn't feel like, oh, there's a song that somebody did, but they're not really part of the band. Do you know what I mean? It's like, again, you know, it's like mm-hmm. putting a band together. And look, we played the Brits. You know, we all played the Brits, which was fun. And yeah. then We got a Grammy for a song from a movie that nobody had seen. So that's not such a bad thing either, yeah. you know? So I suppose we did okay.
Yeah, you definitely did. Was it a slight, not a strange experience, but when you are stepping into something that there's a, I don't know, there's wallpaper already in the room, so to speak, you know, in terms of...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I was trying to be, both Steve and I were trying to be, I was going to say we were going to be extraordinarily respectful of what John Barry had done, but then that's not really it. We loved it. Hmm. We loved it. And so we tried to make this architecture, which would absolutely start with John Barry and be very much his sound and only slowly merge into a more Zimmeresque thing. So that by the, you know, plus we had that great song that John had written. I mean, yeah. you know, big reason for it why that song exists in this movie, and I think it really pays off. And hearing Louis Armstrong one more time is, you can't really go wrong there, right?
We have all the time in the world, time enough for life to unfold all the precious things love has in store. We have all the love in the world. If that's all we have, you will find we need nothing more. Every step of the way will find us with the cares of the world far behind us. We have all the time in the world just for now. Nothing more, nothing less, only love.
So, yeah, I know what you mean. You know, the many people have gone before us, and there's a lot of stuff that you can draw on, but there's, you know, but those are all treasures. Look, I know how it happened. You know, it's like, if there's one thing I can say about Barbara Broccoli and her brother Michael and Denis that they have in common, they lead with unbelievable kindness. You just feel you're part of the family. You just, you know, well, we were friends anyway, but you know, it's like, but everybody, I mean, I remember, it's like, we were calling on Valentine's Day, and Barbara went down. I know she was in a hurry to go somewhere, but then she came back in with like the, just the biggest box of chocolates. You know, not many producers do that. Yeah.
There is method in my madness with my hat, actually. I'm just thinking about it because...
Go on, then.
The wonderful thing about having you on is that we've talked about you so much on the podcast with just some of the directors that you've worked with on numerous occasions, be that Ron Howard or Guy Ritchie or Ridley or Nancy Myers or Christopher Nolan. And I have to say that whenever I get asked what is my favourite soundtrack, Interstellar is my answer every time. Probably up until I heard June. But I think that there is something incredible, very special about that score.
Well, it was written very much for my son, Jake, who during that time, he was 16, he was interning for 3 weeks at NASA. So your hat is very meaningful. And after 3 weeks, I got a phone call from NASA and them going, do you think we can keep him for a little longer? And I'm going, yeah, of course you can. What's he up to? What's he doing? They're going, well, we'd rather not say. You know, and so when he came home that night, I said, what are you doing? What are you doing at NASA? He goes, well, Dad, really, they asked me not to, you know, not to tell anybody.
I love that.
So that turned into his last 2 years at school, moonlighting at NASA, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning. And I still don't know what the project was, which is good, which is great, you know. And then they offered him a job and he said, no, I really want to go to university. And they said, well, we're keeping it open for you for 4 years. So, you know, it's like Interstellar means a lot to us. I loved writing that score. I really, truly loved writing that score.
I think the fact that when Christopher gave you that, sent you that little kind of
letter. I know, that was more about Jake, that, because he knows Jake, he knows my son, you know, that letter. It's not dissimilar to that, you know, that moment of Denis just very quietly going, have you ever heard of a book called Dune, you know, or Barbara phoning me in the middle of the night going, what are you doing? What are you up to? You're going to come to London. I think the reason I never thought I would do a Bond movie is out of the obvious reason, that which is, who would have such hubris to ever assume to do something like this? You know, and there was a moment too of going, oh dear, you know, I don't want to be the guy who ruined it for everybody, you know?
Yeah. Listen, we're about to run out of time, but just a couple of things I quickly wanted to mention is the fact that, you know, when you look back on the incredible collection of scores you've worked with, and I was just picking out some of my favourites back to like Thelma and Louise and Days of Thunder, I love as well. Yeah. Oh my God, they're so iconic. And it's kind of, you know, when you look back and you look at a list of them, it's like, how has this man been physically able to actually create all this wonderful stuff? And I know you talk about your band and you collaborate, but what's been really nice as well is we've had quite a few composers on who have almost kind of come through with you, and they talk so highly and about your generosity and your encouragement, you know, and the way that you nurture people as well, that you see talent in people and you want to help them and you want to help them grow and you want to...
No, it's not, you know, it's not I want to help them. I want to hear their music. I get excited when I hear John Powell or Harry Gregson-Williams' music. Genuinely get excited by it. So, no, I mean, Steve Massaro, Dave Fleming, you know, all those guys, I mean, they're incredible. They're incredible. I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
I come from having loads of ideas. I don't have to be precious about it. I don't have to go and, you know, guard my little corner. I don't care. I can go and do something else. Well, I mean, what do I do anyway? You know, I mean, you know, look, we spoke about Johnny, you know, and the person we didn't speak about, so I'm dropping his name, is Pharrell. You know, those two were the ones who were beating me up going, I remember exactly the sentences. You owe it to your audience that you look them in the eye. You can't sit in a dark room all your life and hide behind a screen. You have to go out on the road. You have to, you know, and me going, no. No, I mean, you know, I'm surrounded by bullies, by friends who are bullies, and they're right. Yeah, I'm terrified of everything, and I'm not terrified of anything at the same time, if you know what I mean. It's like you just got to go out there and you got to say yes. You know, I remember Cool Runnings. I loved Don Steele. I loved the idea. I thought it was really funny. Right? I thought it was great. And somebody's saying, what are you working on? I'm going, I'm working on a movie about the Jamaican bobsled team. And they're going, that's stupid. I'm going, no, it's not. It's hilarious. It's fantastic. It's like, you know, who would have thought it? And I just say yes because I can see, I can see something in these things, you know.
Boss Baby. I love Boss Baby. I can't wait for the new Boss Baby film.
Oh, I love Boss Baby. Come on, Boss Baby.
Can't wait for the new Boss Baby film. It's so good. I've got two kids and we have watched it so many times. We can't wait for the new film.
Oh, no. Absolutely. And again, I mean, it's a director, Tom McGrath, that I've worked with, I don't know, maybe 20 years now. I mean, We did all the Madagascars together, and you know, we did some really crazy stuff together. But Boss Baby, I mean, it's full of heart, and it's imaginative, and it's brilliant, and Alec is brilliant, you know, and you get to hang out with your mates, and you get to make a noise, and you get to, it's I'm not complaining.
Neither am I, sir, that I got the chance to chat to you tonight.
That's great. It's brilliant. It's brilliant to see you.
And thank you so much for your time. And I hope we get pick up again and talk about Top Gun and go back and talk about loads of other stuff as well. Hans, it's an honor.
Oh yeah. Luckily they moved by God, I mean, I don't think I can talk about three big movies. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
just showing off now.
Yeah. Right. No, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, totally. Right. Take care, sir. Thank you. Much love. Bye bye.
Be well. Much love.
From the score to No Time to Die, that's good to have you back, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Hans Zimmer. My huge thanks to Hans for taking the time to talk to me. Obviously, it would take about a week to go through all the great scores that he's brought us, but hopefully our conversation gave you a little insight as to how the great man works. If you haven't already, please do go and seek out, in fact, here's three films that we mention in the conversation today out in cinemas: Dune, No Time to Die, and Boss Baby 2. And my lads and I actually rewatched Cool Runnings the other day, so go and seek out those films and enjoy. Head to edithbowman.com to hear my chat with some of the directors he's worked with, including Guy Ritchie, Gore Verbinski, Ron Howard, and Nancy Myers. And you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK, where we post little video clips from the interviews, amongst other things. I'll also try and stick up the full conversation with Hans up on the YouTube channel as well. Next up, as I said, we have the likes of Chloe Zhao, Pablo Larraín, Reggie Yates, Paolo Sorrentino, Lin-Manuel Miranda. We'll have another episode up for you on Monday. So if you aren't already subscribed, make sure you do that now. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.